history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories out there that need to be told, and we're not going to hear them unless we take the time to ask a few questions and listen to whatever may come of that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, I'm in Barstow, California, home for more than four decades, to Bob Izumi, who's got a story that in some ways is almost hard to believe. The life experiences that you've had, the places you've been, the things you've done for our country. We're going to hear about decades and decades of service to our country in one way or another in different branches of service, the Army, the Air Force, the Marines. But tell me about growing up in Southern California. Big family. You got a lot of brothers and sisters.
I was a kind of a loner from the rest of my brothers. I never was close to any of my brothers, except for, I think, Herbie. But he never was in the service. But he was an engineer for Douglas. Frank, he was MIS. And my brother George, he was a baker. And my brother Tom, I don't know what he did. And my brother Roy was an electronics man. They're all in the Army. The only other one was Jack. He went in. Then the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. He had to stay, in there for the rest of the duration.
Oh, wow. So this is Los Angeles in the 1930s, and you're growing up in a Japanese-American family, and you weren't alone. The Japanese-American culture in L.A. at that time was very rich and very prolific.
But I didn't go to any of the Japanese schools to learn the language.
I've heard some stories about that you've had people try to speak Japanese to you in recent years when they honor you.
I couldn't do it.
Well, what was your childhood like as far as school and activities and maybe even the dreams or ambitions that you had growing up?
Yeah, junior high school, I didn't, still was just about two of us that were all good friends. That's where, you know who Norma Jean Baker is?
I think a lot of listeners will recognize that name as the future Marilyn Monroe. Oh, you got a picture right above me of Marilyn Monroe, and it's autographed by her.
Yes.
And she was your classmate?
Yes, sir.
In junior high?
Yes, Emerson Junior High School, and she went to University High School there. And I think she quit school in the 10th grade, and she kind of blossomed out after that.
Did you have any indication of future stardom for her?
No, she was very homely.
Did you ever throw spitwads at her or anything?
Oh, no. Never did, no.
Well, some people, depending on their priorities, they might say, hey, did you know that Marilyn Monroe went to school with Bob Izumi because of all the things that you've done since then? Tell me what you remember about December 7th, 1941.
December 7th, I was roller skating. I'll never forget it because I was roller skating with a guy named Chuck Fine down Santa Monica Boulevard. And then it came through the radio and everybody stopped and listened. Then I roller skated home after that. I asked my dad, did you hear the news? He says, yeah, I know. I heard the news. And then my dad wouldn't talk too much about Japan or things like that. But he was a very honorable man to me. He was a man that my brothers didn't understand him, but I did. I would sit down next to him, and I can see in his face that what he wanted me to do. I didn't speak Japanese to him. I just knew what he wanted. The rest of the brothers, my dad would take me into town and fill up the gas tank and everything. And it was kind of odd because my dad liked me, and, well, he liked all the rest of the sons, but I think I was more close to my dad. I have a rocking chair. It was made way back in 18-something.
Wow.
And he took it all the way into Manzanar and brought it back. And when he passed away, they were going to break it up. So I brought it and I redone the whole chair.
Wow. What a treasure. And so much that chair has been through and survived through. As you talk about that relationship with your dad and on December 7th, and I should point out you already had a brother in the military at
that
point.
Yes, Jack was in the military.
Did it start to hit you that being a Japanese-American on the West Coast was going to be an issue?
I didn't think anything about it because I was little. And even in camp, I didn't. I thought it was a thrill being in camp because those towers and had a machine gun. I think they had a water-cooled machine gun. I didn't know what a water-cooled machine gun was until I got in the service.
Sure. But you thought camp was a thrill. I don't know if that's going to register for some people listening, because if they know the history, they know 120,000 Japanese Americans on the West Coast were forced out of their homes and sent elsewhere. And for you and your family, it was Manzanar, right, inland, but not too far away. But how did you handle that news at the time, that everything you've ever known, your home, your neighborhood, your friends, your school, you're not allowed to be there anymore?
I didn't think anything about it. See? The older people helped. I realize that now, but as I was a little one, I thought it was a thrill seeing a Caucasian in uniform with their rifles, and I'll never forget it. We had to take a stamp in the little tag, and they stamped me C4. You know what C4 means?
Oh, 4C. Enemy 4C. Alien.
Yeah. Right. They put me an alien. Most people don't know that. They tore up all of our birth certificates.
They tore them up.
Yep. And we were aliens. Yeah. I didn't think nothing about it.
You're born in this country, but now you're an enemy of this
right.
country. Held hostage behind barbed wire.
Barbed.
What about, I mean, a big family like that, I'm sure you guys had a lot of stuff. Every kid probably had.
My mom put everything into, we had a cellar.
Uh-huh.
But I found out later on in the years that they looted that cellar and they took everything out.
So while you guys were in the internment camp,
right,
someone went and they found all your stuff in the cellar. So yeah, you, probably everybody in your family had.
Oh, we
real...
had something in this.
Yeah.
It's all gone.
What about life in the camp? How did you pass the time? What kinds of things did you do?
Well, there was three of us. Like I said, I didn't really fool around with other Japanese-American kids, except for the two. We snuck under the barbed wire. We watched the spotlights. We knew when the spotlights passed us, and we dug a hole under the barbed wire and went up where the stream came down. We made a pool and jumped in there and cleaned up, and I wish I would. I'd go up there and see if it's still there. I don't know.
I wonder.
Yeah.
But then you still had to get back in the camp without getting caught, right?
Right. We knew when the spotlights were.
What do you think would have happened to you if you got caught?
Well, there was an incident about that. It was a man that did the same thing. He walked toward the mountain, and he was an old fella. He couldn't have never get up that mountain without no ropes or anything, but they said he was a spy and everything. That's what I heard. So I guess the military police went up to the mountain, couldn't find him, but where he was, they found him the following, after the winter was, they found him sitting on the rock. I mean, he was froze.
Wow.
Yeah.
I know you said it was a thrill, but was there anything about being in the camp that seemed unfortunate to you or a challenge to you?
It didn't hit me until I got out of the service and I had to go do my own thing. The reason I got out is a teacher named Helen Ely from Iowa said, Bob, he says, do you want to get out of here and finish high school in Des Moines, Iowa? I said, I would do that if you get the okay. So she wrote back to Washington, D.C. and if I had any bad marks against me. But there was no mark against me because I was just a youngster. So the government okayed it. Then I went back to Iowa. My brother Roy and I got on the bus and went to Iowa. Roy went to some other town, but I went to Okoboji Lake to be a person. You walk into a hotel, like a bellhop or something.
A bellman or something, yeah.
Yeah, bellman. Uh-huh. And I was that really nice. Anyway, so the little boy come up to me and he says, how come you don't have buck teeth? And I said, what do you mean? So he got in his back pocket and had a comic book with the Japanese with the buck teeth with a rising sun flag.
Oh, man.
And he says, how come you're here? I said, I'm an American. I'm here because I have to finish my high school. And he just left. But I'll never forget the way he said that.
Yeah, I can see why that would stick with you. And a lot of people probably haven't heard a story like that. I mean, they've heard about neighboring families maybe who took care of a Japanese family's land or possessions.
Right.
But so this was a school teacher in Iowa?
She volunteered from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, to come into Manzanar to teach school. And then there's a fellow named Mr. Greeley. He was a professor from USC, but he was blind. And the guys in the class says, let's bet who can sneak out. But I guess when a blind people knows each step or can hear what's going on,
they think they can get away with sneaking out of class because he's not going to see
it. So they bet me that I said, I'll bet you I can get out. So that day, took my shoes off, and I start walking out. He says, where are you going, Bob Izumi? He did say that.
How did he know it was you?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying.
Boy, talk about having a sixth sense.
Yeah, he was good, Mr. Greeley. There was quite a few teachers I admire, and I wish Helen was the most one. Yeah, when I got to Des Moines, Iowa, there was a lady named Angel. She worked in the USO, And when I got in the service, I came back and looked her up, and she and I became good friends. And that's where I met a lady. I told her, my wife, about it. A nurse. Her name is Doris Wynn, W-Y-N-N. And she was from Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina. She gave me her high school ring. She said, please write to me and I'll write back. So we wrote back and forth, and all of a sudden it stopped writing. And I wondered if she was alive. And my wife and I told her about her. So anyway, we looked up Doris Wynn. There were hundreds and hundreds of Doris Wynn. So I started dialing, and I got tired.
So you never found out?
No. It's all right. She was a pretty woman. She was a pretty, pretty woman.
You mentioned, you know, getting into the service. Now, a lot of people, they think, well, if my country is holding me and all my family members captive behind barbed wire, the last thing I want to do is go put on the uniform and fight for that very country that's holding my family captive. How did that happen for you? How did you become part of the U.S. Armed Forces?
Well, my brother Jack was in the service, so I said, well, I'll go in. As soon as I finished high school, I went to the Armed Recruiter in Fort Des Moines, Iowa, and joined the service in September 1944. Then from there, I went down to Camp Landing, Florida.
So how long until they put you in the Go for Broke unit, the 442nd?
From September 44 till November 44. So I didn't stay too long with them. November 44, I transferred into the 101st Airborne Division, and I was in Reims in France that 44. You had camps over there named after cigarettes, Chesterfield, Marlboro, Philip Morris, and I stayed there, and I met Pee Wee Martin.
I want to hear about all that, but I don't want to miss anything here. So as soon as you go into the Army, they say, okay, you're Japanese-American. You're going with all the rest of the Japanese-Americans in the 442nd. Did that strike you as different or odd? I mean, in today's world, that segregation idea, I think, would make people's heads spin.
I didn't think nothing about it because when I joined the 442nd, they're all Japanese with black hair. So I didn't think nothing bad about it. It was a fellow from New York we call Hoppa. Hoppa means half and half. I got kind of mad at one of the guys because they were picking on him because he was half and half.
He was half Japanese and half
white, or Caucasian. So anyway, they kind of picked on him and everything. And finally, Lieutenant Brown knew what was going on. They discharged him. They gave him a discharge, so he got out. And that's the only incident I know of that, I mean, prejudice type.
Mm-hmm. Not spending a whole lot of time in that Go for Broke unit. I'm sure you still take pride in the accomplishments of the 442. What do you think people today need to know about that unit and the things that they did and the price that they paid?
Well, we were a close-knitted outfit. We never did go away. If somebody got wounded, we'd take care of them. It was a very close-knitted unit. We were the most decorated unit in the United States Army. I had a very good friend named Jimmy Eno. He got 18 bullet holes in his hips. They shot him. Then I saw him again when the war was over. He lived in Littleton, Colorado, and I saw him. He became a priest.
How about that?
Yeah.
Well, was there a moment for you that was the indoctrination or the baptism? When did you first realize how dangerous a situation you were in?
Oh, well, the dangerous situation is when I saw this pilot come down, and I was, I don't know, a couple thousand feet behind him, came down and crash landed. And Mac, the medic, saw him come down. The OP told the medic, the squadron, and the pilot crawled out of the ship. And it caught on fire. And the pilot put this parachute over him because the Germans were on the left-hand side and the pilot was on this side and they were shooting at him. So he covered his body with his parachute because it was white and you couldn't see him. So this Mac got him out of there and I helped him with, put him in the Jeep, took him into town. And after that, I didn't see him until 60-some years later, which I didn't know.
Well, yeah, this is an incredible story, and I know there's others to tell, but we might as well hear the rest of this now. So this is a gentleman just recently passed away by the name of Harry Krieg,
right.
P-47 pilot, flew tons of missions over there, and you helped rescue him during World War II. But just here in the last few years, you're going to a dinner here in the Barstow area that they do every year, right? A veterans dinner?
Yes.
Tell me what happened, how you found out who this guy was. And
well, I didn't know who he was until he tapped me on the shoulder, and I swung around like that, and I was going to hit him, and he backed off, and he was a colonel in the Air Force, retired. We talked when the newspaper heard about it, and they interviewed us. And I saw him a couple of times and talking, but never met his son until just after he passed away.
But, I mean, it's 60-something years after the war, and a guy taps you on the shoulder and says, hey, you're the one who came and rescued me.
Well, I didn't rescue him. I helped rescue him.
But still, I mean, what are the odds of that? 16 million Americans in uniform, and he happens to run into you in this fairly remote part of California?
Yes, it's 1,000. I don't know. I can't explain. Well, I'll give you another instance. As we were marching out in January of 45, a little girl, I got a picture of a little girl come up, grabbed me and gave me a hug. And I said, okay, okay. I pushed her away. 60-something years later, this lady came up and hugged me and kissed me here and kissed me here three times. That's the Belgium. And I pushed her. I didn't mean to push her away, but I pushed her away. And she said, don't you remember me? I said, no. I said, I don't remember you. She says, do you remember a little girl giving you a hug when you come out of the forest? I said, yes. She said, that's me.
Wow.
And then each year I would thought, she's in a home now, but I would go there each year. I mean, she would bring me a great big plant of poinsettias.
Well, and the reason these people can be sure it was you is because you're the only Japanese-American in the 101st Airborne. That's
yes.
How they know if that paratrooper was Japanese-American, and you're the only one. But before you got into the 101st, and I want to hear that story, how you got into the 101st, did you see any action with the 442? Were you involved in any engagements?
At the end, I was an anti-aircraft man.
Uh-huh.
And not too much, just lobbing in there. I didn't see too much with the 442nd.
And how does a guy from the 442nd, which is made up of Japanese-Americans because they're not letting them do anything else other than be interpreters or work with language in the military intelligence service, how does a Japanese-American soldier of the 442 get into the 101st Airborne?
Well, I just volunteered for it, and later on I found out Andy, he's passed on. Now, Andy, he went through jump school a week before I did, and he jumped in Kwajalein.
All right.
For that island.
Uh-huh.
And there was quite a few MIS in Merlin Marauders. Ben Kuroki, Sergeant Ben Kuroki, was a tail gunner in the Air Force. So I told my commanding officer, there is Japanese Americans in other services. There were quite a few in the Navy also, but I didn't know that. I volunteered for the paratroopers, and I didn't have no backlog, right? Being, oh, you're a dirty Jap or something, you can't do that. I didn't have nothing like that. Even in my regiment, Pee Wee Martin would, he was my mentor. I went through jump school, and it was good, and Fort Benning, it was, I would do it again. The guys were just a big family. It was really close. It was, we were more closer in the 506G company than I was in the 442nd.
Really?
Yes, really close. It was, I'd do it again.
I believe it, and I know it was another company from your regiment, Easy Company, that became known as the Band of Brothers, but sounds pretty applicable to your unit, too. Time to take our first break now, but we'll hear about Bob Izumi's time with the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment when we come back. We'll also follow him to Korea and Vietnam, and in between, his work with test pilots, some famous names there, and even a couple UFO stories. Find photos of Bob then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 92-year-old Bob Izumi of Barstow, California. In different parts of his six decades connected to the armed forces, he's been part of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the 101st Airborne. He served in the U.S. Air Force later and concluded his career at a Marine Corps post. We'll get into that, but when we left off, Bob had left that Gopher Broke unit, the 442nd, with so many others who, like him, had come out of the Japanese internment camps. And Bob, you volunteered to be a paratrooper.
What were your duties with the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment?
Oh, just an infantryman. When from Bastogne, Captain Cannon said I'm going to be a lead man. I was a lead man going up toward Haguenau, the last concentration camp we liberated. And then from there, I don't know who took the pictures of me. I was a lead man going to up to Butcher's Garden.
That's Hitler's Captain, hideout there.
And Captain Cannon says, you better wear that hat, steel hat. I said, sir, I didn't get hit real bad. I might as well not get hit now. So I didn't wear my hat. Somebody took a picture of it, and it's in the book. I'll show it to you later.
You kind of glossed over Bastogne there. You said after Bastogne, but that was a big deal. A lot of guys lost their lives there.
Most of them were froze to death.
Right.
Jim Martin would show us how to make a foxhole, and we would cut branches, great big branches from the forest there, and lay them down. And then we would put leaves on top, and then the water would go underneath it. But most guys didn't do that. Most guys would just dig a hole in the morning. They would froze to death.
I know you lived through it, but a lot of people listening right now, you know, they weren't alive for any of this. They don't know where Bastogne is. You know it's in Belgium. You know how cold it was.
Yes.
But explain for our listeners how it was that you guys ended up there and what happened once you got there.
Well, we were in Reims, France, got the news where we were going to be trucked into Bastogne. The Red Ball Express, which was all black unit, they were the drivers. They got caught behind the lines after we took us in there. Anyway, we went in there with the Red Ball Express. And then there was a American Indian unit, was the Code Talkers, but we don't say thank you for the Code Talkers there. Think about it. They only have a little monument. But if you go to Bastogne, it's all about E Company with a band of brothers.
You do hear more about them than anyone else.
Right. You're so right. Why? Why? General Patton was there with all the tanks. 82nd Airborne was there.
Mm-hmm. And you were there. And what were the conditions you were dealing with? How challenging was this just to survive from day to day?
It was just cold. It was a railroad track. And across the railroad track was the farm. Aubrey Jackson and I, we would zigzag into that, break into the farmhouse, and we would get warm sheets and things, take them back. Because we weren't ready for a cold climate. They just trucked us in there, and that was it.
And it was the coldest winter that anyone there had ever seen.
And about 4 feet of snow.
It's something you're not used to from Southern California, I'm sure.
Well, like I said, Pee Wee Martin showed us how to survive it. And the guys, some of the guys, three-quarters of them wouldn't pay attention to him. I can see him plain as day now. He was out in the field with a mortar, and you can see the shells from the Germans trying to get him, but he would lob these mortars, and he didn't even get a Bronze Star or things like that.
Well, and I'm sure the enemy gunfire, artillery, mortars, whatever, they probably weren't very far from you either.
Oh, no, maybe from here to the next corner.
Do you remember some moments that, looking back on now, you say, hey, that was a pretty close call? I was fortunate to get through that?
No, I never thought about that.
I'm sure you dealt with friends of yours getting killed.
Oh, yes. Well, Andy Matuzovich, he was, I think about him in Vietnam the same way, or Korea. It was worse in Vietnam than World War II.
Well, and I want to hear about that and hear why you feel that way. But as far as what was going on in Bastogne, it was bad. A lot of people did die. A lot of people were wounded. But it could have been a lot worse.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
When did you guys have a sense of what was going on? And was there a time where you thought, hey, we're trapped here and we're never getting out?
No, I didn't think about that. Christmas Eve, we sang Silent Night. Everybody stopped firing. And the Germans stopped firing. And we heard the Germans singing Silent Night also. And after midnight, hell broke loose.
So to hear the Germans singing Silent Night, you have to be pretty close to where they are.
Yes, sir. Yeah.
How far apart were you?
Maybe about 100 yards.
So the Germans are 100 yards away. Snow everywhere. You guys have been fighting each other all this time.
Right.
And it's Christmas Eve, and you hear them singing.
And we sing. But right after that midnight, hell broke loose.
And what kinds of things are you doing during this time? Are you just trying to stay where you are and fight people off? Are you making patrols? What's going on?
I had the M1 in my foxhole, and I just dug in a little higher. I mean, a little slower. And then when the 88 comes in, you can hear the 88. It'll go whoosh, 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 whoosh. And if it hits close to you, we jump in there because the shell is warm.
So you let the 88 come in, and then you run and jump in that hole, and
it's
going to keep you warm. How often do you think you did that?
I did it twice.
That means the shells are coming pretty close to you.
Oh, real close.
But it's not going to land in the same place twice.
No, sir. Right? No.
I know you've talked about this a lot over the years, so it may seem like no big deal. But most of us have never lived through experiences like this. And you're still just a very young man. Were you scared? Did you think that maybe you wouldn't be coming home?
No, I didn't think thought about it, even through Korea and Vietnam.
Never scared?
No, I never. I was scared, but I never thought about death.
Wow. Maybe that's why you made it through all of that. Maybe that has something to do with it. What was the hardest thing for you to deal with over there in World War II?
Losing my friends. Yeah. I wish they were here, but here there's only Zelensky, Pee Wee Martin, and I. That's the only three I know of. I'm not the original. Zelensky and Pee Wee Martin were originals. They went all the way through D-Day, Holland, and all the way through. Ed Zelensky was hit in Bastogne, but Pee Wee didn't. He got hit, but not hit hard. Pee Wee was a very good friend of mine, is a very good friend of mine, and there's a guy named Dennis Moore. I don't understand this, but in the 214 is your record. Doesn't show anything about Dennis Moore. Doesn't show anything about Andy Matuszewicz. Doesn't show nothing about Aubrey Jackson.
So their records don't list them being in
The 506, no.
Really? But they were with you the whole time.
Yeah, see.
I've heard a lot of stories like that. Then what happens is people get called liars.
Oh, the same way. I can tell you. I received the Vietnam Medal of Honor. I saved a pilot over there, but it doesn't say nothing in my file. But I have a picture of Nguyen Cao Ky coming down from Saigon, pinning the medal on me.
Right. But because it was another government's medal, they don't have it on your DD-214.
No.
And I want to hear about Vietnam and the Korean War. But give us a sense of what you guys did in the 101st after Bastogne. And how much did you guys have left, body-wise, strength-wise, after Bastogne?
Oh, the company was still there, but I didn't linger too much with the other companies. Mac was in headquarters, and Bob Dunning was in headquarters. So our companies stuck together all the way into the Rhine River. Then from Rhine River, we went into Hagenau, liberated the last concentration camp there. Then from Hagenau, marched up to Birch's Garden, then Birch's Garden down into Salem Zee. In Utendorf, and then winter was set in, so Colonel Singh says, we're going to pack our duds and leave Austria and go to France. So we went back into Jaunay, France. We all got together and made our last jump there. The high pointers went home, and I was a low pointer. So from there, I went to the 508th G Company, Colonel Mendez. I loved that man. He was a wonderful man and made the jump school in Bad Homburg, Germany.
You mentioned the concentration camp, liberating
yes.
that.
Yes.
You were there.
Yes, sir.
What'd you see?
I was walking in. Captain Can was to my right, and there was a, I hate to say that, but he was there. And then we were going to cover him up because he was dead. Then another man came in, a real skinny fellow, and he came in. He opened up man's mouth, pulled out his teeth, and put in his teeth, and walked away.
Another inmate.
He knew what the gold teeth meant, I guess. So he just took it and...
Wow.
Yeah.
I know it's not easy to talk about and not pleasant. Could you believe the kind of condition that those prisoners were in?
Oh, they were awful. I can't explain it until when I was in concentration, in the camp.
At Manzanar.
Manzanar. It was almost like that. You just had the bed and you had to make it really nice and with straws and whatever.
As far as the accommodations, it right. reminded you of Manzanar.
Yes.
But the conditions of the people there...
were worse.
I would think quite a bit worse.
It was.
And you probably didn't only see survivors. You probably saw the people who died there, too.
Right? Oh, yes. I didn't see that. The only survivor I saw, I didn't pay attention to that man that came. And then Captain Ken says, let's go. And that's when they say Easy Company was there first, but our company was there first. Our company was in Hitler's hideout. First, I got pictures of that.
And did you know that at the time? Did you know what you guys were going into there?
No, no.
Garden?
No.
Tell me about that.
We went in and they blew out the windows. The window was, I guess, about 18 inches thick, but they blew it out. And then down the cellar, I think Colonel Sink, the regimental commander, was there. He took all their barrels of silver and he took those silver coins and made chalices for all the officers. All the officers got chalices.
So while you were there at Hitler's Eagle's Nest, did you guys become aware of its significance and what it was and who had been there?
Oh, no, I didn't think nothing about it. I got pictures of me sitting my foot on top of up the great big window that was blown out.
Uh-huh.
I left there, and the captain says, we don't have no rations or anything. So went down to Utendorf. Bob Parks, he's gone now. Anyway, Bob Parks and I said, let's go up and find a deer or something, meat for the company. So we walked up there, and I saw a cow. And I said, I'll shoot the cow, but I don't know how to skin it. He said, I know how to skin it. So I shot the cow, and we pulled it down, back down, and he skinned it, and the whole company had fresh meat, and we ate pretty good. So 67 years later, again, we had a reunion in Xenia, Ohio. Captain Ken says, before I go from this earth, I want to find out who shot that cow. And we all said, why? He said, because the burgomaster, which is the mayor, I had to pay the burgomaster for the cow. And Bob Park says, Bobby Zumi killed him.
Three under the bus, huh?
Yeah. So then I said, well, I killed it, sir, but he skinned it. Then Captain Ken said, okay, I'm satisfied.
You know, that brings something up. You talk about having no rations there at that point later on in the war. But what about at Bastogne?
You didn't have hardly any rations.
I mean, how bad did it get?
It got bad when we had to go across the way and they had a farm there. The guys would steal eggs, things like that. But two guys were killed when they went back into town. The railroad track went like this. We were over here. 502nd was here, and the 506 was here. So these two guys are coming through the railroad tracks, and the 50 Deuce guy says, halt, who goes there? That's the way I understand. What's the call sign? And they were so drunk, they just laughed it off. So the 502nd, we don't blame him, but he opened fire and killed both of them.
Just because I didn't know the call sign.
But these two guys went all the way through D-Day and Holland.
Tragic.
Yes, sir. Things like that. It's another guy was from Iowa. He said, Bob, I can't walk anymore. So I took my knife and I cut it open. And as I took his shoes off, the whole it just blossomed out like a balloon. So we got a jeep and medic took him in the town. And 60-something later, I saw him again. He says, Bob, thanks a lot for what you did. He would smile.
For cutting his shoes off.
Yeah.
And getting the medical attention.
Yeah.
And that was at Bastogne?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
My grandfather, I think I told you, was in the medical corps in Bastogne. And
I bet you he saw some.
He said, yeah, that's what he saw mostly, frozen feet. Right. Not a lot of wounds, not a lot of bullet wounds,
no,
a lot of frozen feet. And you never got wounded?
No.
Beating some odds?
No.
With the places you were?
Well, even in Korea or Vietnam, I didn't think about it until I was ready to go home. Then I thought, oh boy, I'm free, I'm going home. My son and I was in Vietnam together.
Yeah, not many people can say that, and we'll get to that, but what about the end of World War II?
We were packing to go to Japan. He says, PFC Izumi, he says, we're not taking you. I said, why? He says, because you're a Japanese-American, you did too much here. I said, my brother is over there. Oh, he says, no, they're not. I said, there's quite a few MIS in that area.
Yeah.
And he didn't understand that. He says, well, I'll transfer you, that's where, to the 82nd Airborne. And then the Japanese signed the peace treaty, and then I went to the 82nd anyway.
The war ends. You come back home.
From Fort Ord, I took a bus down to West Los Angeles. We stopped in Mojave. He says, this is lunch break. So we all got out, and I went inside. The proprietor says, we don't want any Japs in this cafe. I said, sir, I just got through coming and fighting in Europe. He said, I don't give a darn if you what you did. So he kicked me out. And the bus driver says, what's happened? So I told him, I said, don't get mad. So anyway, he went in there and says, my bus is from Greyhound. I'm going to tell him that we will not stop here anymore.
Wow.
And he did that. And the second incident was when I got out, I went work for Chrysler Limited in Beverly Hills. When a lady came in and says, if that Jap is here tomorrow, I'll tell all your customers not to come in here. She was a well-to-do. So I told Mr. Messenger, I said, I don't want no trouble. And the next day, I went to Long Beach recruiting station there, raised my hand and went back into service. Went into the Army Air Force. I went to Scott Air Force Base. Sergeant Hatfield, I remember him. If it wasn't for your relatives or your people, my dad would be alive. I said, that's nothing to do with me. I didn't do it. So I said, don't make a difference. I'm going to wash you out because you're a dirty old Jap. And I tried. And anyway, I learned code. One I really remember was, da-da-da-da-da, that's number 7. Scott Field chicken. That's how I remember it. And everything I start remembering it. And he worked so hard to wash me out. And at the end, graduating, I said, Sergeant Hatfield, I said, I'm sorry, but I made it.
Well, and I'm just imagining what it's like to be in your shoes. Here you go through the war in Europe, some of the most dangerous places of the war in Europe. You're risking your life for the country that has been holding your family hostage. You don't deal with discrimination in the army, in the war. You come back home.
And I get it.
You get it. And that's what causes you to go back to the service. You say,
yes,
hey, if they don't want me working at the car place, I'll go back in the military. And then you run into it there, too.
Right.
That had to be really disappointing and disheartening.
Well, it wasn't after graduating out of that school in Scott Field. I went to Edwards Air Force Base, Army Air Base, working in the control tower. That's how I learned to be a control tower operator at Nellis. I went to March Air Force Base. And that's where I met Janet Leigh.
Wow, the actress.
And John Wayne and Howard Hughes. Howard Hughes picked me and two guys to become his personal control tower operator. At the end of the pictures, and he left the C-121. It's a Constellation.
Yeah.
He left it at the, we call, dry base, where he left his aircraft there. And left it there for a year. He forgot it anyway. After the made the picture, he gave me a Texas Fifth. You know what that is?
It's a lot of alcohol?
I still have it.
Still have it?
Yeah.
Given to you by Howard Hughes.
Yeah. It's whiskey. It's full of whiskey. I still have it.
What was the picture they were filming?
Oh, jet pilot.
Jet pilot.
Uh-huh.
John Wayne and Janet Leigh.
Yes, sir.
And you were the guy he chose.
In the control tower.
Uh-huh.
It's break time again, but we'll hear about another Hollywood star Bob came into contact with, not in school like Marilyn Monroe, not because they were making a film like John Wayne and Janet Leigh, but this time because this gentleman actually flew missions from Bob's base in Vietnam. We'll also hear about the time Mr. Izumi defied an order. He was both punished and celebrated for that. The Air Force gave him a Bronze Star, the Vietnam government its Medal of Honor. Find photos and videos of this unique veteran at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Bob Izumi of Barstow, California. Two-thirds of his nearly 93 years on this planet have been spent actively connected to one branch of service or another. It's been 10 years now since he retired from the Wood Rock Hobby Shop at Marine Corps Logistics Base Barstow. He's busy in retirement, too, putting those woodworking and lapidary skills to continual good use. We've heard some of his stories from Bastogne, Belgium, where he survived the snowy siege during the Battle of the Bulge, and even a little from his Air Force career that spanned the Korean War, the Cold War, and Vietnam. He shared briefly about the things he saw when his unit liberated a concentration camp in World War II, but in Korea he witnessed another humanitarian crisis. Caves near his base had become dumping grounds for infants.
The Korean lady who was pregnant would have their baby there, and they would leave their babies in that because they were, I guess the Korean culture, if they weren't married legally, it's very bad. So they would take that, have the baby and take it someplace.
So you found babies?
So we found babies and take them to Shingwan Orphanage. I received the humanitarian award.
We're not talking just one baby.
Oh, no, not one baby, a whole bunch of babies.
Oh, man, that's got to just tear your heart apart.
Oh, it did.
But you guys went in and you saved all those babies' lives.
Right.
Got them to the orphanage.
Right.
And who knows where they are today?
I tried to find them, but I can't.
They'd be in their 60s now.
Oh, more than that. Talking about that, I saved a little boy. I got a picture of him. We called him Snowball. Aubrey Jackson and I saw him in the snow.
This is in World War II?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I said, look at that guy out there. That boy. He's naked and he's in the snow. So Aubrey said, let's go get him. So I got him. In German, he said, what's his name? I said, what's your name? And he went like this. So Aubrey says, I know, we'll name him Snowball. So we took GI blankets and made a suit for him. I got a picture of him. And as of today, General Patton's daughter is trying to find this guy. He might be gone by now, but I don't know.
Wow. So you stay in the Air Force through the Korean War and through the Vietnam War as well?
Yes, sir.
And you made a statement earlier, you and your son were both in Vietnam.
Right. He was 30 miles south of where I was.
What did that feel like?
I didn't.
Were you more concerned for yourself or for
your son? No, just for my son. My wife knows how old he is. He's pretty old.
And what were you doing in Vietnam?
I was a control tower in Seoul.
And you got a Bronze Star for something you did over there?
Saving a pilot.
How'd you do that?
In Vietnam, they say you're not supposed to be, Americans are not supposed to be there. So if this pilot went down, you know what DF is?
Tell us.
Direction finder.
Uh-huh.
He mayday'd, and I found out where he was. And in Vietnam, you had to go through village 1, 2, 3, 4 village chiefs to get okay for me to go in there to get him. But the chief says negative, you can't go in there. So I went to my commanding officer, and my commanding officer said, what'd you do? Did the village chief say no? I said, that's right. He said, okay, you can't go in there. So I went back, and I hit the button. I didn't care. And scrambled a Huey to go get him. And he got him, and I got reprimanded for him. And he turns around and gives me a Bronze Star.
So the same person reprimanded you and gave you the Bronze Star?
Yeah.
Because he had to reprimand you?
Yeah.
Because you didn't follow protocol?
Right.
But you saved his life?
Saved the pilot life. I'm not that way. The man who went in there saved the night.
That's but if you hadn't done that, the helicopter wouldn't have gone.
Right.
And he would have been captured.
Yeah, right. He would have been captured or been killed.
But he might still be missing over there, so many thousands are.
Why are we there for? I saw, you know who Jimmy Stewart is?
Sure.
I saw him fly an A-1 out of that base and go on a mission.
You know, a lot of people don't know that. He flew bombing missions in World War II.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
But they don't know about what he did in Vietnam.
Yes, sir.
He was a much older man.
He flew missions. I saw him going into the A-1.
What does that say about the kind of person he was?
Wonderful. People don't know that. He did that. Raymond Burr?
Uh-huh.
He was there. He was entertaining the troops.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Barry Mason goes to Vietnam.
Yeah. Uh-huh. See, people don't know that.
How long did you stay in the Air Force?
30 years.
And you would think, so 442 and the 101st Airborne, two of the most legendary units of World War II, then not out of the service very long at all, into the Army Air Corps, turns into the Air Force, you stay in for 30 more years, they would think, hey, that's enough. This guy's done enough for our country. He can get away from all this military stuff. But not you. That's not what you thought.
I love the service. I would die in the service if they let me.
Yeah, you'd go back in right now.
I sure would.
Right? So tell us what you found next as a way to serve our country and to serve our military personnel.
Well, I stayed in the Air Force, met Neil Armstrong. I flew with Neil Armstrong.
Flew where? Flew what?
Flew F-51, tandem. He was the pilot and I was in the back.
Oh, you're the passenger behind.
Yeah.
Yeah. And how did you get to do that? How did you get to fly in the back seat with Neil Armstrong flying that Mustang?
I asked him, I said, I'd like to fly in that Mustang once. Because I know I love that Mustang. I'll show it later on. So he said, sure, sure. Flew with him in there.
And this was long before he became the first man on the moon.
Yes. You know who the first man into space is? Gagarin is the first man who flew in there. But who beat him in the space?
Alan Shepard?
Mr. Robert White. Colonel White.
Oh, that's right. Uh-huh.
He flew the X-15 and held it. And he's the first man to get the astronaut wings from the president.
Uh-huh.
Most people don't know that either. Well, I knew him when he was a captain, and I knew Captain Kinchlow. He was the first man to be picked as an astronaut, and he got killed on a 104.
Was this all at Edwards?
Yes, sir. I flew 3 times the speed of sound with Mr. Johnson in a B-58.
3 times the speed of sound? As a passenger?
Yes, as a radio operator. I think about things like that, but like most of the people I know are gone, like Captain Kinchlow, Colonel White's gone, Mr. Johnson's gone. Captain Apt, Merlin Apt, he flew the X-2, and that's my opinion now. I think Chuck Yeager did not go through the barrier. I think somebody else did way before. But since it was an Air Force base, and political-wise, they gave it to Chuck Yeager.
So you think someone did it before Yeager did, and just didn't get out?
Yeah.
Is there someone you want to give the credit to? Do you know who it was?
No.
You just know it happened because you heard the boom, or what?
No, just know what happened.
What aren't you telling me here?
I just don't want to give that name.
So you know who it is, but you don't want to out that person.
Yeah.
Exactly. I bet there are some other things that most people don't know that you became privy to at Edwards.
Yeah, well, they had what you call North Edwards. I was in charge of that control tower in North Edwards. And then I was picked to go there because I was NCOIC.
That means non-commissioned officer in charge?
Right. So I went there. We had a control tower. We'd have an aircraft take off out of there. It was pitch black. You can't tell who it was. So then I'd go and clear for takeoff, and I'd lock up the control tower and go back. It was just like Area 51.
There are a lot of experimental things going on there.
Oh, yes.
That were top secret.
Yeah.
You got any UFO stories then?
Have I? Yes, sir, I got one. And I was in charge of the control tower in Norton Air Force Base, and a guy named Sergeant Roop and I were on duty. And Desitel's A, B, and C position. And then I saw this great big white light over Dock 1. I said, "Rupert, do I have a camera or nothing?" He said, "No." He said, "Look at that white light there." And it just hovered there. Didn't make no noise. So Norton, across away, was AC&W, radar. We call him up there and says, "Do you see that object on top of the stock?" He says, "Yeah, we see it. We see it on our radar." So the lieutenant, he says, "That'll be right up." Anyway, in the control tower, we have what you call a form 1132. We, every hour or on the hour or every minute, anything unusual, we type it in. So I typed it in everything. Then when the lieutenant started coming with that doggone light, whoosh, went toward Cajon Pass. And the lieutenant came in and says, "Where's that form you typed?" He says, "You can't take it." I said, "You can't take it without my commanding officers. Sorry." Pull the sheet out. He said, "You didn't see that thing, did you?"
Wow.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
So the implication is he knows what it is.
Yeah.
He doesn't want anybody to know about it.
Yeah. Then the one I saw in Oxnard or Fort Bay, on the south side was a big mountain there. There was a light there, and we saw it there. And so I hit the button, what you call alert hangers, and they had F-86s. And the F-86 went up, chased him, and he couldn't catch him. That's the only two I seen.
What do you think those were? Were those American experiments?
I don't know. If it was an American experiment or not. I think we have things that, I mean, why should we, we'll say I'm a test pilot, why should I tell the nation what I'm flying?
Especially, why should you let your enemies find out?
Yeah, same thing.
Sure. And I'm not trying to put thoughts in your head. I'm just wondering what your, because you saw it, I didn't. I'm just wondering what your opinion is. Because, you hear people late at night on the radio and they say, "Oh, those are the people from outer space." You hear others who say, "No, it's all governments here that are spending a lot of money testing experimental aircraft."
Well, I think we have something to do with it.
You think?
Because I seen it.
Sure. And that lieutenant tearing up your paper, I mean.
No, he just took it.
He didn't tear it up. He just took it from you.
Right.
And then even after you got out of the Air Force, you said, "Okay, I've already checked off the Army and the Air Force. Why don't I get involved with the Marine Corps?"
I did.
Tell me what you did.
Well, a fellow named Mr. Hedberg Gunny, he came up to Travis Air Force Base and says, "I'm here to interview you for a job for the U.S. Marines." So he talked to me and he says, "Well, you got pretty good qualification. Why don't you come on down, since you are of the service now, and come into the Marines?" So I told my wife, and I drove down there, and I liked what I did. I taught Marines how to make furniture out of pallets.
So leftover pallets from forklifting things around?
Right, and those pallets were made out of oak, maple, purple heartwood. I'll show you what I made out of it.
So you spent how many years doing this?
30.
30 years teaching Marines woodworking?
Yes, sir.
Where did you learn?
I learned how to do woodworking and lapidary work in Korea.
30 years? I mean, you just stopped in your 80s.
Yes, sir.
What were you getting out of that? Why were you doing that?
Because I love the service and I love the people in uniform.
So all those years where you were teaching woodworking, is this to give these Marines something to do when they get out of the service, or to pass their time while
just
they're
pass
in?
Them time while they're there.
So what kinds of things would they end up making?
Like that coffee table there. I made this table. It's all out of pallets.
Wow. You wouldn't think a beautiful table like that could come out of pallets. That's my kind of recycling. So you did that for 30 years?
Yes, sir.
On the Marine Corps base?
Yes, sir.
What made you decide to finally let that go and stop doing that?
I can't think of his name. He says, 30 years is enough. If I had my way, I would still stay there.
Because this was a job.
Yeah.
This wasn't volunteer work.
No.
This is a government job to run that program.
And I loved it.
And you'd still be doing it right now if they let you.
Well, I do it at home, yeah.
Yeah, now you do it for yourself.
Yeah.
Well, there's probably a lot of people out there who've got a Bob Azumi original somewhere.
Oh, right, yes. House, huh? Quite a few teachers that I met. They still have. I made baby cradles.
What a gift to so many people. And you mentioned being a guest of honor. You've been the guest of honor at a lot of places. You went to Washington, D.C. when all the Japanese-American veterans of World
right.
War II were given the Congressional Gold Medal, the highest civilian honor. And there you met President Barack Obama. But many, many years earlier, you met another president of the United States before he was president.
Eisenhower.
What was Ike like?
Mr. Ike was very, I can't explain it. But I think Mr. Patton was much better than Ike. He would stop and say, "How's everything going?"
This is Patton you're talking about?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. But that president, General Ike, he would just, I would just shoot with my rifle, and he'd walk in. That's it. But General Patton was, well, I'll never forget it because he would stop and say hello and say, how are you doing? You need any help? But he would be there. I was there when he was hit by the weapons carrier. Every year I go, Helen Patton would give me the honor to lay the wreath.
You've been a lot of places, done a lot of things.
No.
I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country for so long, and thank you for giving us a little taste of some of your adventures. Is there one part of all of it, of this whole life experience, which is pretty hard to believe that a guy who had 4C enemy aliens stamped on him has done all this for our country and for the rest of us? Is there any part of all of that that you would say you're most proud of today?
I'm proud to be an American. I see a flag flying. Boy, I'd salute that flag every time, anywhere. But most people, they won't do that.
Well, maybe they will now after they heard you say it.
No.
What is it about this country that you love so much that you think other people should maybe feel the same way?
Freedom. They don't know what freedom is until they take it away from you.
And that happened to you.
Yes, that's why I do it again. I don't know when I walk by and everything. If I don't know you and I'll go walk by and I'll tell my wife, just a minute. She says, I know what you're going to do. So I'll go up to you and say, what do you look so sad for? And then all of a sudden you smile. Oh, that's good. Thank you very much. And you're smiling. When I go to a restaurant, I was eating, and I saw this man pull the chair out for this lady. So I told my wife, will you excuse me? He said, I know what you're going to go. So I went over to the gentleman. I says, may I say something? It's very unusual these days for a gentleman to pull a chair out for the lady. And I should thank you. And I walked away. 10 minutes later, here comes a bottle of champagne. I don't drink. Yeah, it's true. Things like that. People are not happy nowadays, if you look at it. People seem to have a negative attitude. Why? Before you know it, you're going to be 90-something years old like I am. Before you know it, I'll be gone.
Well, I guess that's the only other question I have to ask you, Bob. Your life story is so colorful.
No, it's not colorful.
Oh, it sure sounds like it.
Oh, yeah.
You've been through some incredible things. You've met some very famous people, even today. They want you at the Dodger game or the Angel game to throw out the first pitch, and 50,000 people are giving you a standing ovation. And
right.
Presidents want you to come to Washington, and everybody wants you to go somewhere. Is there something you haven't done yet that you're still looking forward to, that you want to do?
No, I think the good Lord there. I didn't believe in the good Lord until maybe a few years ago. But during the war, I got the Bible there. A guy named George, I can't think of his name, he gave me a little Bible, and I still have it. And he underlined what I should, if I get in trouble. I say that going through Jim's Google and Bastogne.
So what changed? You had that for 70 years before it meant anything to you?
Yeah, I didn't. That the verse meant a lot, but I didn't realize that there is somebody or somebody upstairs that's much, much, he has to be superior.
I don't want to pin you down or anything.
No, go ahead, pin me down.
So they gave you a Bible in World War II, but you said only until a few years ago you didn't believe in the good Lord. But now your perspective is what? That he's been looking out for you this whole time?
Yes, yes.
Do you see evidence of that now when you look back? Do you see situations where you say, maybe he intervened on my behalf there?
Yes, yes. Why did I save children that I don't know? Why did he give me the courage to do that? Why did he give me the courage to continue 30-some years in the service? Why am I talking to you when I'm 90-some years old? People think I'm in my 60s. I don't feel like I'm 90, but I appreciate it. People better enjoy life because it's really short.
Words of wisdom from a man who has had quite the journey. That's Bob Izumi of Barstow, California. Photos of Bob and links to some of the many articles about his unique military distinctions are up for you at hometownheroesradio.com. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we hear from another veteran like Bob who knows what it's like to live behind barbed wire, in his case, as a prisoner of war. We will be reminded again, as we were today, that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all a reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.